Perfect. Yeah, we are. We're dedicating tonight's discussion to this teacher, Michael Stone, Shokin Michael Stone, who died unexpectedly over the weekend, leaving a family of young children and his wife pregnant. He's 42, younger than me. Our paths were in many ways parallel. We both started in Zen and insight meditation and practiced in parallel in the yoga tradition. And both in recent years opened toward more engagement in kind of activist circles and social justice conversations. And I didn't know him well, but we were kind of distant peers. He was up in British Columbia most recently and Toronto before that. Beautiful teacher, especially strong teacher, writing and thinking about practice completely immersed in like Western lay life, in ordinary life. So a practice that doesn't turn away from the world at all. A beautiful, beautiful teacher, and you can go and listen to some of his teachings. Stone, Michael Stone. So tonight, in honor of him, I'm glad you're here. I'm so sorry. So I'm going to talk about a body of teachings known as the Divine Messengers. This is named after a moment in the story of the historical Buddha, Gautama, speaking to the encounters, four individual encounters that changed his life and turned him toward the path of practice and eventual liberation. These were encounters that happened to him when he was inspired by curiosity at one point to leave his sheltered palaces. He had been raised in intense privilege, and the myth that arose around this story has kind of exaggerated it to the point of you know, extreme kind of isolation and privilege. But in a certain way, many of us who grew up in many parts of the United States, even if not wealthy at all, are sheltered in some way from some of the more profoundly startling violence in other parts of the world, or in other parts of our own country. I grew up in a Bay Area suburb out in Livermore, and it was a pretty quiet upbringing. So we weren't wealthy at all, but, I was pretty sheltered from violence and poverty and this was the case for the Buddha. But when he's in his mid-20s, which is about the time I also was like, I got to get out of here. After graduating from a fairly privileged and sheltered college, I went to art school for music. I told my folks I was going to hitchhike across the country. My dad said, why? Reasonable, right? Dadly answer. I hope I don't give exactly that answer to my kid when he wants to do something dangerous, but I probably will. I said, Dad, I'm 23. Like, if not now, when? And he said, how about never? which was not lying, but the parallel between me and the Buddha is only going to go so far. But here's the beginning of the parallel. The Buddha's father, who is this king, or at least kind of, big landlord of an area, we could say, princely kind of landlord. He had had a prophecy when the Buddha was born, and the prophecy was really, really high. The sages said, oh, this baby is going to be either a great ruler, a great king, or a great holy man, a religious person. And the dad was like, I'm voting for king, right? He really was like, power is where it's at. And so, and then he had this insight that if he could shelter his son from pain, his son would not turn toward religion. Now, right, the dad sort of like, he got it right in a certain way. There's something about the shelter of profound privilege that doesn't allow contact with life in the way that would turn one toward the path of liberation. And so, so dad tries to shelter the kid, and eventually the kid escapes, as kids do. So my dad says, how about never? And I'm like, sorry, you know, it's just like, and I had been reading too much. I was like, dude, dad, like Jack Kerouac, Gary Snyder, like, come on, you know, these guys, they were out there, you know, Bob Dylan. And my dad was like, come on. So I left San Francisco, where I'd had a temp job at an accounting office, because who knows. I left with $35 in my pocket and my violin and a backpack. And I started hitchhiking. And I hitchhiked down through LA and out across the desert to Albuquerque and kind of up through the mountains. I had a whole time. And some bits were dangerous. In eastern Colorado, I was picked up by a pair of folks to judge by the pupils of their eyes and their tattoo adornments, I could only call Nazis on speed. Particularly because one of them turned around and looked at me, the driver, and said, "Do you do speed?" And I was like, oh no, I'm in one of those bad movies where, like, you know. Anyway, nothing bad happened, you know, there. God bless them. May they be well. And so the Buddha goes out of his palaces, and he goes into the town, and he starts seeing actual people living. So I want us to do a little imagining here, a little version of this ourselves. And the first person he sees is a really old person. So I would like you to think back and remember the most recent time or a time that stood out to you in your life when you saw a very old person, someone like pushing a walker along or using a cane, somehow in their body really showing their age. And just for a moment, see the image of this person. You don't have to know them. And then as you see the image, the practice is this. In the heart and in the way that you're seeing a human body, an old person, to not turn away. Like to let your inner gaze rest with this person. See the body bent by age, affected by age. And this doesn't have to be positive or negative. You can say, oh, that's so beautiful, or it's so frightening, or it's so... Whatever your reaction is beside the point. But the reality of aging. And the formal practice goes like this. My body too, if it lives long enough, will become like this. This is my nature as well. I will age. And just see what happens. See what it feels like. See what the little wave of turning to face this truth feels like. And then just letting it go. Let them go on their way. May they be well. And if you want a sort of palate cleanser between divine messengers, you can let your eyes just look around the room and come back to where you are now and feel you feel yourself now, not bent by age yet. The Buddha saw that old person, went back to the palace, confused, fearful. He had never seen one before, says the myth. He said to his driver, who was, of course, working class, what is this? Prince, this is an old person. Will I become like this? Right, this is a 26-year-old rich kid. He's like, could that happen to me? Yes, right, it must. He doesn't sleep well that night, the story says. He goes out again the next day. So now I want you to think of a recent time when you saw someone very ill, very, very sick, dangerously sick. I think for many of us who live in the urban centers, we see these people on the street, folks the system is not caring for. You might think of someone you've seen who is clearly ill. And in the same way, the practice is to see it, to not turn away, to not close the heart to it, to this person, but also just to the reality of sickness. This is sickness. And then again, the reminder of our own intimacy with sickness as a body. I too am subject to sickness. I have not gone beyond sickness. If I continue to live, this will be my experience. Something like this must be my experience. And again, just noticing the response. If doing this is too intense, and I completely acknowledge that it can be, don't do it very intensely. Right? Kind of glance lightly out of the corner of your eye, as we do when we see folks on the street and it's too much. And then keep your eyes open and see the room and just feel us here. You're with friends. Don't get lost in the image. Feeling this body. And the antidote in a certain way to getting lost is to feel health. This is health right now. Don't let the mind sweep you away, but still seeing clearly. Gratitude for health right now, but clear-eyed non-denial. The Buddha went home again that night, troubled. The third of the four divine messengers. I want you to think of a time, and not all of us may have this experience now because of how in denial or fear our culture is. But I want you to think of a corpse that you have seen, if you've seen a dead body. If you haven't seen one, you can think of a friend who has died recently, even if you didn't see them. Or you could think of a fictional image. Don't think of a hyper-dramatized one. This isn't about action movies or fantasy. This is about the simple realness of a body not breathing. Again, if this is too much, don't do it. Let it be over there in the corner of your eye. You know this is real, and that's enough. Keep your gaze open and present here. Feel this breath that is life. But if you can bring to mind the image, letting your gaze rest there, maybe even with eyes open, and just knowing that in yourself. And again, the practice is this body must do this. It's the nature of bodies. Formal text says, I am of the nature to die. I have not gone beyond death. And again, noticing the response. The Buddha's response was basically terror. He He said to his driver, "What is this?" "Prince, this is someone who has died. Could this happen to me?" "Prince, it must. It happens to everyone." The fourth divine messenger is different. So these are the first three. And one of the versions of the myth says that these three beings that the Buddha saw, an old person, a sick person, and a corpse, were actually gods in disguise. That in order to turn his path toward liberation, he had to see these things. And so the king of the gods himself manifested in these forms in his path as he walked through the town so that he must see them. This is a practice you can take to the practice of living with the very signs of distress on the streets here. You see someone and you can say, perhaps this is a god who's here to wake me up from the delusion I've been lost in. I like the version that it's a god waking him up. I also like the version that it's not, and it's just people. That's true too. I think they're actually not different. So the Buddha goes out a fourth day. And this time, I want you to think of something different. I want you to think of someone that you've seen who has the bearing, the attitude, who radiates something different. For the Buddha, this was a monastic. He saw somebody walking in robes, begging for alms. And he said, wait, there's something different about this person. This person has an uprightness, a noble bearing. There was something unruffled about this person's demeanor. So who is that? And the young prince could tell that everyone else was kind of running along, worried and fixated and afraid of these messengers, afraid of sickness, afraid of old age, afraid of death. He said, but this one was different. And he could tell something. He said, well, who's that? And his driver, the charioteer, said, oh, that's a seeker. That's someone who has left the home life and the pursuit of security in material things for a life of simplicity and the search for freedom, liberation from birth and death. And instantly the Buddha says, that's me. That's what I'm doing. And he goes home and he puts his affairs in order. His family will be taken care of there. He actually comes back very fairly soon, and most of the family follows him into the holy life, including his son, his wife, his stepmother. And he sets out on his search. And his search is specifically the search for the deathless. Right? He actually goes in search of how can I be free of this exact thing, old age, sickness, and death. This mirrors the search in a text that is from about the same time in the Katha Upanishad, where a young seeker named Nachiketas leaves his home after an argument with his father about the proper way to conduct a sacrifice in true ethic and goes to the home of the king of death to ask for the secret to what is beyond death. And death teaches him yoga, and that's the beginning of yoga, taught by death to someone seeking how to go beyond death. That's about right. Yeah, straight up. So who comes to mind for you that is in this position? Doesn't have to be an enlightened person, whatever that means. Someone for you who is living in a way that could show you something that would help in relation to these messengers, in relation to old age, sickness, and death. Someone who, when you think of them, the terror or the contraction of those first three messengers lightens somewhat. Someone who could say there is a path, there is a way to live. See who comes to mind, and again, just let your gaze rest seeing them and see what happens. The message here, I think, is something like, there is a path. Seeker, there is a path, there is a way to walk toward freedom. It's important to notice that the Buddha wasn't seeing someone that was already enlightened and free. He was seeing someone on the path of seeking. That's all it took. I too can seek the deathless. His practice took him 6 years. And after the whole arc of practice, nearly dying, finding the path of the middle way and awakening fully, when he finally decides to teach, it's said again that the king of the gods appears to him and instructs him to teach. For a moment, he says, the thing I've discovered is so subtle, no one will get it. I think I'll just chill out here by this tree. It's so nice. And the king of the gods once again appears. You could call this again a divine messenger. Appears to say, blessed one, look around the world and see that there are folks with little dust in their eyes who will hear what you have to teach. And the Buddha then looks and sees that that's true. He hadn't looked yet at people. I think he was still tripping on how incredible it was to be free of death. He looks around, he says, oh, people, some people are going to understand this. And the first people he thinks of are his own teachers, his yoga teachers from before, who were not yet liberated, but who were very, very close. And he says, oh, I should tell them. I should tell my teachers. I found it. So, you know, in case you discover anything out there under your trees, like, come and tell me. Yeah? Come and tell me first. I want to know. But he actually looks with his divine eye, with his kind of purified vision. He notices that his teachers have died since he studied with them. And he laments that they were so close to liberation, and he could have shared this last bit of secret with them, and that they had passed. He sees them in the heaven realm. So then he sets out for Varanasi. And again, to complete this meditation, in a sense, on death, when he announces that he's going, he says, I go to Varanasi to beat the drum of the deathless. So he goes with some force. I go to Varanasi to beat the drum of the deathless, to announce loudly that there is a path to the end of suffering, and the suffering is the fear of death. So whoever you came to mind, noticing the feeling of, in a way, whatever it is, but something, for me, it's like inspiration, but it's also, it's not even quite that. The person that I thought of, I'll just tell you, was one of my teachers, Sylvia Borstein, who's now quite old herself. And all I saw was, in a sense, what in a way was her smile. She would sit up at the front of the hall and she would just beam kindness. Her primary practice was loving kindness. And you could kind of tell. Or she was just this very wise grandmother. She is a grandmother. She started practice in her 40s when she had several kids already, which is inspiring. Start late, it's okay. And she was just one of the most at ease, loving people I ever met. So.
She's still alive.
She is, yeah. She's, you can go find her. She teaches on Wednesday mornings up at Spirit Rock. Somewhat less and less, but she is there. She's out there. Go do retreat with her before it's too late. That's true for all of your teachers. That's also true for all of your friends. It's true for yourself. Right? Do the deep practice or being or living that you want to do while you're alive. Yeah? So in a way, our practice with death in many senses, to be not supernatural about it, not to be like, here's the deathless people, but in a very, just in this world, in an ordinary way, the practice with death is like much of our practice, it's the practice of non-denial. The bulk of the practice is the practice of non-denial. And it's not like you're in active denial, right? I mean, maybe you are. Yeah, you know. But probably not. You know, you're thoughtful, sensitive folks. You would come to a meditation class over and over, mostly talking about suffering. Like, really, there's more fun places to go on your Tuesday evening. So you're not in conscious denial. What the Buddha points to, and what the whole yogic path points to, is that there's an aspect of subtle denial that is embedded in us. It's just there. And it's some way that, like, and this is so mysterious, it's almost like part of the developmental process of being alive has to do this somehow. And this is mysterious. I don't know why. Lots of religions have reasons why, but I'll say that it seems mysterious. But that almost that to be a self and a person and a relationship and to do things requires, in a sense, just not looking there. Being like, yeah, that's true, but it's almost, maybe nowadays more than ever, it's hard to hold it close. Until it comes close by itself. Until the divine messenger, you know, you don't have to go out and look for it. Your friend, your partner, your mother, your father, your teacher stops breathing suddenly. And the longer you live, the more this will happen.
More likely.
Yeah, more likely, more often. Somehow this has been a big year of it. I've lost a number of folks this year. Seems to sort of go in waves, but who knows? Our practice is to care for ourselves and each other in this, of course. When I heard the news of Michael Stone, before he died, he was in a coma for a couple of days. I wrote to my friend in Toronto who was very close friends with him. They wrote a book together. I wrote and I said, you know, oh God, I just heard. I'm so sorry. I don't know what to say. And my friend just wrote back saying, you know, I'm so glad you wrote. Hold everyone close. Our practice must be to stay awake in the whole of life. And then when we do that, something else is possible. The Buddhist tradition is famous for being the people who are good with death. Right? We're the folks that like open hospices and hang out with dying people and do really good funerals and chant and I think it's because differently than some other religions, there's really this beautiful emphasis that is not that hard to find, strangely, even if not in the absolute, like you found the deathless way. But there's a way to not be so afraid of it. Partly we just talk about it. over and over, I'm like, this is real. And as I've practiced, at one point in my practice, I was like, I need to know more about this. I'm 26. I've never seen a corpse. My grandparents died on the other side of the country, and we didn't even go to the service. What's up with that? And our whole country is such that, like, I'd never even really seen a very old person because they disappear. People disappear as soon as they can't walk around anymore. It's profound denial. So I was like, you know, I've started Buddhist practice. In Zen practice, which was Michael's central practice, was my beginning practice. Outside of the meditation hall, in many traditions, there's a big chunk of wood. It's like a plaque, about yay big. And there's a poem written on it, and the gets translated in various ways. The one at our center said something like, it was in Japanese, so this is only a very rough kind of translation. It said, birth and death is the great matter. Life is short, practice now. Basically that, right? And so every morning at dawn, we'd be sitting, you've been sitting for a while, you're in that kind of before dawn sitting state, it's wild. You've also been up chanting for an hour with this drum, and then sitting, and it's dark and kind of cold. Why was it always sort of cold? I don't know. Just kind of cold, pre-dawn. And then at the first glimmering of light, and the signal for this traditionally would be that the one to do this thing would go outside, and if you could see the lines on your palm, it was time to hit the board, the han. And so a monk would go out with this big wooden hammer and would do this rhythm and would just whack this like 4-inch thick chunk of redwood, just like boom, boom, in this kind of accelerating rhythm. Tack, 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 whack. And it would go on for like 10 minutes or so, this kind of rhythm. And it was as if they were kind of beating this prayer out into the canyon. And you would hear it, you're sitting, and you would just hear the rhythm, and you would know what they're doing. They're hitting this board. Birth and death is the great matter. It is why you're here. Practice now. There is no other time. There's a tradition in the Zen Center. So as you hit it over the years, it's this huge piece of wood, thick. A big dent would appear in the wood over time. A really well-used one would have this huge gouge in it. Micro sort of wearing it away, every whack slightly wearing it away. Eventually, the board breaks. Whenever the board breaks, maybe it happens once every couple of decades, right? It's like takes a long time to beat a hole in a piece of wood. When the han breaks, the entire structure of the Zen Center stops. Right? No matter what you're doing, you could be in the most intense retreat of the year. Everything stops. A feast is made. No more practice.
Oh.
You can't keep practicing until you build a new one. And you have to ritually paint it and dedicate it. Because what are you going to do? Like, you've broken the timekeeper of your life. Everything stops and you have a party. And one monk goes down to the wood shop and starts building a new one. I asked at one point if the monk that was beating it, if it was really, really worn, and the monk that was beating it was having a really hard time and was just like really hitting it hard. And the person I asked was like, oh, that wouldn't be, you know, that wouldn't be good practice. Right? You're not allowed to try to break it, right? You just have to keep hitting it. So there's one approach to life and death. So I'll end by just saying that even in the beginning years of practice, something is possible when our core practice is to show up at the center of our own lives, as we sit and as we cultivate this wakeful presence, and to see clearly and not turn away from each moment's arising, from this out-breath that could be the last out-breath, we don't know, from the moment-to-moment fluctuating waves of feeling that characterize our days, to not turn away, and that no matter how hard practice is for you, no matter how much it's just like suffering, I just keep encountering all of my neuroses and my anxieties, and I just keep trying to show up for myself. One of the things that grows is a kind of strength, a kind of beautiful presence. And it's that presence with which we start to meet more and more of life. And the gods start to show up more and more, showing life to us. Michael Stone's center was called Center of Gravity. His community is now simply called Gravity. It's a good name. Good name. So I want to just offer a blessing to his family, his wife, his kids, his friends, his students, to all of us, our families, our friends, our teachers and students, our communities. The moment of death is uncertain. Each breath, life, expressing itself for one more breath. May we live our moments fully and with as much wisdom as we can. May we all find our way together all the way. Thanks for listening, hanging out. It's really a pleasure just to be part of this group, just to say, all these years. I hope to not leave you suddenly. Nor you me. Don't go anywhere. Yeah. So some time for your thoughts and feelings, reflections.
I'm really sorry, I didn't know Mike Stone. I didn't know of him, but yeah. I'm thinking of him and his family. And right after I read the post that you made on Facebook about him, one of my best friends contacted me and informed me that someone, you know, one of our mutual friends had committed suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And they found him. Like you said, there's been waves of losing people more than I've ever experienced in my life in the past, like, you know, 8 months. I feel like it's been really intense.
Yeah.
And
I'm so sorry to your friends and their family.
Yeah. One of the things that I've been thinking about is how, you know, he struggled a lot, Nick, who passed, and I just think about how it's a privilege to be in the state that you were describing, where you show up for yourself, you make the choice to show up for yourself, because I've just been wondering, like, did he have that ability?
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that he just, you know, or is that something that he, that wasn't accessible to him because of, you know, the conditions that he was born into? And mm-hmm. I'm just wondering about, like, you know, choosing the path of liberation in the context of it being a privilege.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think both of your proposals are true, that it is available to all, but it's also a conditioned arising, like everything. And so when the conditions are not appropriate, for it to arise, it can't arise.
Yeah.
So even to say it, to talk about it as a choice is one, is part of it. But in the way that, that, you know, I talk about privilege essentially as favorable conditions, if we depoliticize it, like, there's ways that privilege creates harm,
mm-hmm.
right? But it is, but it's a certain kind of set of conditions, conditions toward comfort, conditions toward spaciousness, toward resource, centeredness. So, yeah, health is a privilege, you know. Time to practice is a privilege. The Tibetan tradition calls them precious. Or these calls these the conditions of the precious human life. Right? Freedom from crushing poverty. Freedom from debilitating illness. Freedom from living in a war zone. You know. All of the conditions, having a mind that is stable enough to practice, all of these things. And it doesn't make one who has these conditions better in any way than any other being. There's no value judgment, you know. It's like saying that, you know, a gnarled tree growing out of, you know, a sidewalk crack in a really deserty environment that barely has the resources to become, to live at all. It's like saying that's a lesser being than, you know, a great redwood growing in a moist, dank grove who has all the conditions to thrive. It's just, they're just different conditions. There's no value judgment possible or justified. So no one's at fault in this. This is karma. What we try to do then is in a sense, the service aspect of our practice is, can we create the conditions in the world for more and more people to live more fully? And for some of those people, it's going to mean to seek, you know, to do liberation kinds of practice. But for other people, it's to do other kinds of practice. You know, can we make the conditions such that the musicians can make their music and that the, you know, the writers can write their work and the bakers can bake their bread. There's a beautiful text that, where a country is falling apart into crime and chaos, and the Buddha says, the way out of this situation is to distribute resources. So for the king to, you know, give the farmers grain and land and water, and to give the merchants raw materials and space, and to give those who are hungry food, and to give the, just basically distribute resources such that everyone can do their own work. And so some people, that's going to be, I'm going to go and do liberation practice in the wilderness. Other people, it's going to be, I'm going to make my art, or I'm going to do my thing. You know, I'm going to invent an app that makes it possible for pizza to show up at your door faster. Like, that's their thing, right? They're part of the universe. Is the most absurd example I could think of right now. But so you're right, right? It would that possibility is absolutely open to someone suffering like that, but it's also not necessarily available.
It just turns my own impression of how I of my own story.
Yeah.
Kind of gave another facet to my own story, because my story is like, oh, I went through all this like really difficult stuff that led me here to heal, as if I'd been, you know, broken. And,
yeah.
And so, but yeah. Then he went through really difficult stuff and didn't end up here.
Yeah.
So it's, in a way, it's like, yeah.
Yeah.
That's, it's all still floating around.
Yeah. There are whole realms of practice where part of the healing ritual would be gratitude for what brought you here.
Yeah.
You know. Which doesn't condone harm done.
Yeah.
But which places yourself in non-denial of your own conditions,
mm-hmm.
right? Including aspects of privilege, of course.
Exactly.
Yeah. Other thoughts, feelings, questions?
You know, when you
Sierra.
Just said that it was like to have gratitude for everything that got you here, right?
Yeah.
And like there's a part of my past where I am happy where I'm at right now, and I just have not like been able to get too grateful for what got me here.
No worries. No worries. Yeah.
And I'm like, I want to be.
Uh-huh.
I want to be, and I think it would serve me well to figure out how to do that. And yet I'm not.
Yeah.
I'm just like, it just, no matter how good it is right now, I can't look back and say that was good then.
Well, it wasn't.
Right. That's or to be grateful for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. You don't have to. Certainly, it's not required. I think the pathway that it speaks to, though, is if we took like that last sentence you said, sort of piece by piece, you were said like, no matter how great things are now, and if you just sort of stopped there and you'd be, and take out the no matter part, because that's just comparison, and you could be like, things are great now. And that doesn't mean they're perfect or they couldn't get way better or anything. But, you know, like, you could name many things that are quite beautiful about your life. Yeah. And that you could take those and you could, in a sense, the contemplation could almost be like, this is true. Like, this is just what's happening. And in whatever way, this is a condition for more and more goodness, more wholesomeness, deeper practice, more healing, deeper relationships, richer life. In whatever way this is a condition for that to happen, thank you. Even just to what's happening now. Like, here's this body, relatively healthy, thank you. And it doesn't have to get historical. In a way, the fact that there's wholesome conditions now automatically says that there were wholesome conditions in the past. And those wholesome conditions were not necessarily like everything good happened. It could be like terrible things happened, but there was enough wholesome conditions that healing could happen. And healing is wholesome. There's a list of 12 steps called the list of transcendent dependent origination. Don't worry about it too much. It's one of the deeper lists in the Buddhist scheme. But it's a list that is a sequence of experiences or qualities that leads all the way to profound full liberation. The first of the 12 is suffering. And the second is faith. And it goes on from there into like joy, bliss, wisdom, etc. But that first two, that's where it all hinges. And it's almost like from suffering or the direct experience of suffering can grow, when conditions are ripe, the experience of faith. And from there it turns toward more and more subtle qualities. So the thing I like about this list is that suffering is not like the thing we escape from in order to get onto the path of liberation, but that suffering is the first step on the path of liberation. And this is why in the Buddha's story, he doesn't start his path when he's like, you know, hanging out in his palace listening to the you know, the brilliant musicians watching the dancing girls, which is sort of the myth, very patriarchal myth. But there you go. He doesn't do anything there, right? The hyper-privileged life isn't conducive to practice. So he gets out in the street, he gets scared, then he starts to practice. So in some way, if any of us had a life where there wasn't a wound, some substantial wound in it, we wouldn't be here searching. Because sitting here through your own mind, it ain't easy. So traditionally, that's also the seed of that gratitude. It's like, oh, that happened, and now I'm here. You know? So we don't have to be grateful for the harm. That's not the point. It's that we're grateful for whatever complex of conditions led us here. And so you could start with just the present, you know, and then the truth of having healed so much. And that's kind of the pathway you might explore. Yeah. And again, it always bears repeating 1,000 times. Forgiveness practice and gratitude practice in this way never condones the harm done. Right? It never says it was okay that I was caused harm. And you don't even ever have to forgive, really, although it happened. It seems to happen by itself eventually. But you don't have to try to do that. You know, it's good also to say, that was wrong, clear boundary, go away. And here I am now, you know, in a different circumstance. Yeah.
Can you speak just a little bit about some people, when they have something they suffer through, they don't turn towards seeking, and instead find it off and go into that.
Yeah, but totally. It's a little bit like Caitlin's question, like why, how does it sometimes turn toward, we could say, the wholesome, whether that's seeking or something else? You know, why do some people turn a wound into beautiful art, and some people, it doesn't go there? And again, this is something about, this is in all three of these questions really, something about what are the conditions within which that wound happened, or that came about later on. Conditions is a way of saying, what are all of the different influences? So, you know, maybe someone was deeply harmed as a child, but met, you know, one good mentor in high school, and that was enough to sort of turn them.
Turn them away from seeking the pain of that.
Yeah, it's almost like, it's almost like pain, well, one of the traditional ways of describing it is that we move through our lives with some amount of momentum. Meaning, if we're going in a direction, we tend to keep going in that direction until we get some new information. So like, if I'm really hurting in this moment and I don't get any new information, I will probably hurt in the next moment. Because that force is strong. Many years of pain becomes a strong momentum. It's hard to break, you know, like an addiction. And it is an addiction in a certain way. It's hard to shift. And so what is it that can shift that? Right? If it's a really deeply embedded pattern, especially if the harm was very early, very, very, very early, deep developmental or attachment harm, it can take years and years of supportive conditions, you know, of good friends and good community and therapy and all sorts of things to turn the ship. Other times, lots of good conditions and the harm is small or momentary, pretty easy to shift. You know? So, there's a story in the Buddhist tradition about a serial killer who killed 999 people and was going for the 1,000th. And the Buddha put himself in the pathway of this person. So you can think of someone so lost in a kind of violent delusion, right? Totally, totally lost the thread of human kindness. Killing people and making a necklace of their fingers to wear. Just a horrific image. The Buddha puts himself in the path of this person, Angulimala, he was called. Garland of fingers is what it means. Mm-hmm. And Angulimala sees this old monk and says, oh, he'll be my 1,000th victim. I will complete my vow to kill 1,000 people. Starts running after him. The Buddha just walks slowly and meditatively. But through his supernatural power, the killer can't catch him. He just keeps running and running and running. And eventually he shouts out, old man, stop! And the Buddha turns around and sees him and says, Angulimala, I stopped a long time ago. Now you stop. And he gets it. And he stops. he actually prostrates himself and he says, "I'm so sorry, I've woken up from a delusion, from a nightmare. Teach me." He becomes a monk, becomes fully enlightened pretty quickly. And I'll tell you more of the story at some other point, but he actually becomes the one that you pray to if you're having a difficult labor for childbirth. Strange mystery in the early Buddhist texts. He becomes the patron saint of women in childbirth. So you know, the momentum can be strong, but a strong intervention can shift it. And sometimes that intervention doesn't come. You know, the conditions aren't such that it would come. Your friend didn't encounter the divine messenger that would shift that karma this time. One of the beauties of this path is that if you don't get it this time, you get another chance. You don't have to believe that. But that's the model. We should stop. It's late. Home and bed beckons, or the dance floor, wherever you go after this. Thanks for hanging with a topic like this. And blessings to everyone, to our teachers, to our families. May we encounter and grow in the conditions for well-being and the conditions for deep practice and liberation. And may we provide those conditions for others. Thanks for your presence. Blessings always. See you Thursday morning, a few of you, for history class. If you want to come to that class and you haven't yet decided to, come. You know, take some time off work, whatever. It'll be fun. And offerings of your resources to support the group go in the basket over there. Thank you for your generosity. And I'll see you next week.